Welcome to Life as a Patient Doctor. I'm your host, Stephanie Moss, navigating life as a patient and a future MD. Walk alongside me as I reflect on the challenges and lessons I've learned undergoing medical school with invisible disabilities. Join me as I interview other doctors, students, and healthcare workers on their own journeys. Listen to their unique stories on how they have balanced their health while caring for others in the health profession. Welcome, everyone. Today, I have a very special guest, Contari, who's a first-year medical student, who's a DO and MPH student returning after a leave of absence, or LOA, after having her second child. She had her first child before medical school and took on a non-traditional route to get to medical school, including working in the mental health field during six gap years and getting a master's degree in medical physiology. Welcome.
Hi.
It's so great to have you. I am excited to hear more about your journey. So tell me a little bit more about you.
Yeah, of course. So like a little bit more about my background is that I'm the eldest daughter of like Cambodian refugees. So I was born here in the States, but my family members all were escaping genocide from Cambodia. You know, it was really tough just, you know, having them acclimate to this new place, raising me and my siblings. And we were born here, except for one of my older siblings. So it was a lot growing up. And a lot of why I went into medicine was because, you know, with my parents working all the time, you know, making ends meet for the family, I was kind of stuck with attending doctor visits with my grandparents and being their translator because, you know, no one else could do it. And it's not like my parents' fault. They can't just skip a day of work, you know? So that really exposed me to medicine. And I kept pursuing this route. And even in undergrad, I went to UC Davis. I graduated with a double major in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior and psychology, because I really just wanted to get to know people, get to know the body, and just really expose myself to understanding everything that has to do with medicine. And then after I graduated from undergrad, I actually took a lot of time off compared to the usual medical school applicant or med student. I, like you mentioned, I took six gap years. Four of those gap years, about 4 to 4.5-ish, I was working in the mental health field because a lot of that also had to kind of just stem from my family's history. You know, there was a lot of trauma they experienced and they never sought mental health care for that. And, you know, mental health care was also heavily stigmatized back then compared to like now, which is another factor why they never went to get it treated. So I did a lot of that to really understand it. And that's where like part of my passion is. I really enjoy advocating for people's mental health, especially for children's mental health. I worked as a behavior specialist for children who had a lot of behavioral issues and what they labeled as severely emotionally distressed, which I didn't like the term. It felt odd to label a kid like that, or even an adolescent, which I felt like made it worse on them. But either way, so I was there like almost like a caseworker only just for the behavioral aspect. And I really worked with them to like understand like the root causes of their behaviors, how to cope, how to just regulate themselves. Because, you know, we live in a world where there's just not enough education about it. And it's not something the schools really teach you. And I don't want to blame the kids' parents because they also don't know either. I mean, some of the parents were actually as young as me, you know, like I don't blame them. And then after like the 4, 4.5-ish years of working, I went on to pursue a medical physiology master's degree only because it was a special master's program at Case Western Reserve. And I was just very insecure, had a lot of imposter syndrome about applying to medical school because that was always the main goal for me. Medicine was always the main goal. Everything I did was to really enhance my understanding of the patient's perspective and how to be a better doctor. As I was in my master's program, that's when I actually started family planning. I did get pregnant and I shared my personal statement on my medical Instagram, and it mentioned an ectopic pregnancy. And that was like the first time I personally felt like I was the patient. And I was finally being treated like a patient and having to deal with healthcare providers in this really dark, really stressful time in my life where I was completely out of control. Things happened so fast and I kind of had to just live with it. I mean, everything went by fast. I had the most like empathetic care team possible. I loved my OB who just told me like, a lot of this just happens. And she kind of really jived with me with that. She knew like my way of coping was to look into the research, read the research on it. And she's like, here are some really great articles for you to read. You know, there's not much we can do to prevent this. And it kind of just happens and it sucks. It really did suck. It was my first ever pregnancy. I had no idea what to do. And it just happened. And she's like, this is all we can do. But now you know this and we can just be on the lookout later. And I really love that approach that she gave me. She like went down to my level. She knew how to just empathize with me. She used language that I felt like was helpful for me to cope with the whole situation. And that's where I am now. I mean, eventually I did get pregnant and I had my son during the end of my master's program. And after I had him was when I took or retook my MCAT and then applied to medical school and got in. And now here I am.
Oh my goodness. I had tears in my eyes. I can't imagine going through that experience that you went through of having an ectopic pregnancy. I'm so glad you mentioned it and talked about it because miscarriages in general are so stigmatized, so taboo, and so personal, so painful. It is so brave of you to share that experience because it is, like you said, it's a common thing. It's just part of nature. Sometimes it doesn't end in the uterus, and that's okay. Thank you so much for sharing that and also sharing some tidbits for how that experience will help you as a future physician, a future provider. You mentioned going down to the patient's level, but having a very patient-centered language, that empathy building. I'm sure that experience was so meaningful. And then also you spoke on just your family growing up, being the translator. That is also something a lot of people don't talk about. And a lot of individuals of immigrants that speak other language have to take on that responsibility, which is unfair. I don't know if you've talked about it yet in medical school of the challenge of translators and not having enough translators. But then as a medical student, like for me, I speak Spanish. So I constantly have this struggle of like, do I be the translator for my patient? Like, I love that. But then at the same time, people are paid to be a translator. And also family members, even though it seems like they should be the translator, should not be the translator because there are so many personal experiences. Did having family members that you're then going to and spending time, how that has impacted how you will work with future patients who speak different languages?
Yeah, I mean, like for me, I was really young when I was translating. So for me, it was like, I kind of did a direct translation to my grandparents and it felt weird because there are cultural ways to actually go about it that I knew it felt wrong, but I also didn't know, like as a kid, like, do I say it directly or do I say it in a way that my grandparents are going to understand and hopefully not find offensive? And I think that's like really important because we always say it as like, oh, we need a translator, we need a translator. But more recently in like my public health classes, we talked about interpreters who use that cultural aspect of it so like your patients actually understand what you're asking and not finding the questions you're asking them or the things that you're telling them offensive, you know, less likely to do the things that are actually beneficial for their health. You know, I experienced a lot of that as a kid and even like more recently in my adult years with my grandpa being in and out of the hospital and being evaluated for his mental health a lot, asking those questions directly as a direct translation upset him so much. The social workers, they didn't understand the cultural aspect of it. Like they knew, you know, mental health is stigmatized. You can't just ask it, but it was like really bad, like to the point that my grandpa would try to like AMA if like family members weren't there to just talk him down and actually interpret it for him in a better way. Like, yeah, family members shouldn't, because I definitely knew like my uncles would try to also like withhold certain information from the doctor or even from my grandpa when they were there with him. There's a lot that still needs to be done in that aspect. And there's no perfect answer I have other than just being culturally aware and understanding, like, you know, certain questions are just inherently bad to ask, or certain things to tell your patients are inherently bad to ask unless you have that knowledge of like the way their culture works, the way their religion works, or the way like they just think about things in the world. And, you know, it helps me understand that, like, hey, before I say like diabetes means like you have to do some exercise and you may have to take medicine, maybe I talk about like other factors like, oh, how do you manage your day and how do you manage to find time to relax and maybe do extra things that could be helpful for your health instead of just straight up telling them like you need to exercise, you need to eat healthier, you know? Because that could be really offensive to someone who's already thinking about a gazillion other things. What my family had to think about, they're not thinking about their health first because they have so many other responsibilities and priorities to juggle.
That is so helpful. Thank you so much. I never even thought of that. That is so helpful when interacting with my future patients, and I'm sure it will help so many other individuals who are working with that. I got really excited when you talked about being a behavioral specialist because I was a case manager for children with disabilities. I connected with that so much. Tell me more.
I mean, I really loved that job. The only reason why I knew I couldn't continue is because I was so limited in my capacity. Like, I work directly with the families, with the parents and the kids. I went to their homes once to maybe even up to like four times a week to help them work out their issues. And one case always stood out. They had a lot of things going on in terms of like being bullied, going to a special education school that was out of the district, out of the whole public school system. And it was a lot of work on mom, who actually was a single mom raising her before getting remarried and having a blended family. So there was a lot going on. And then on top of that, she was super young and started having a lot of like psychotic episodes, a lot of auditory hallucinations, which got her bullied even more. And I met with her almost every day, every week, because that's what was required of me. And we really connected because there were just parts of her life that I was like, I can relate to this and I can tell her comfortably without, you know, being too unprofessional, like, hey, you know, kids are mean. I know I'm an adult and you're a kid, but I've been through this too. People used to make fun of me for looking weird or for doing weird stuff, and it sucks. It really does. And just being that open with her really helped her. And she knew like she was different. She's like, you don't hear things, do you? And I was honest with her. I'm like, I really don't. But you know what? People are different. And despite our differences, I still like you as a kid. And I love working with you. That's not going to change. Just giving her that safe space was what I needed. I mean, and I knew she needed that too. And I kind of just thought about like inner child in me, like what would I want when I was being bullied, and came from a really empathetic perspective when it came to working with her. I mean, I did that a lot with all the other kids on my cases. I had like maybe 14 kids at my max, which was quite a bit. You know, working from that empathetic perspective was really helpful. And I think I still carry that with me into medical school. We do a lot of case work in our program and we do a lot of role playing. And I end up just going back to like, when I was a behavior specialist, what did I do here? Like, this may be an adult case, but I can still apply myself in that situation. Because, you know, as much as I love working with kids and coming from that mental health field and all, I have to be able to apply myself too. At least for now, until I figure out what I want to do in terms of specialty.
I love that. And connecting with the person, no matter what mental state they're in, no matter their disability, no matter their health condition, will serve you so well. I'm so excited for you to be a doctor. You're going to be such an amazing doctor because we need more people like that, that can really connect. I do a group therapy for teens. And it's so funny because I literally had such a similar experience with a teen being bullied, cyberbullying. And that is such a good way to connect, is showing that you've had that experience too. Maybe not the exact same, but just by sharing that you're human too and forming that bond really helps, especially teenagers. I would say really anyone, no matter their age, we want our health provider to care about us, see us as a human, and also hear that they're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you don't know what your specialty is yet, and you're so early anyway, which is fine. But have you had any thoughts on that? Have you started your first year?
Yeah, so I started my first year of medical school in fall of 2022, and then I had my daughter at the end of that semester, unable to finish some exams, so I had to take an LOA. And then return just last fall, 2023. Yes, sorry, just getting the numbers right. So I'm technically still a first year, but now I'm in my second semester of my first year.
Got it. That is helpful. I'm actually really interested to hear more about that story of having a child during medical school. Can you speak more about it? I know you do a lot of it on social media.
Yeah, I mean, being pregnant during medical school was, it felt weird because I knew I was the only pregnant person on campus at the time. It was a lot of just trying to juggle, like, you know, the pregnancy pains, had a lot of just round ligament pain, back pain, walking around with a giant belly, going and asking for accommodations because the smell of anatomy lab made me so sick and nauseous to the point where I just couldn't focus. Like if a faculty member came up to speak to us or give us a little bit of extra information about some part of the anatomy, I would just stare at them and it kind of just felt like this blur. Like I saw their face, I saw their lips moving, and I heard sounds, but nothing else. And it got to the point where my accommodations were to just get a little gas mask and just hope for the best, which I mean, it did help. It did help a lot. And then comparing that to when I actually returned after my LOA, redoing the entire semester again, such a different experience. Like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize my pregnancy affected me that much. Without like everything that very first semester was just on top of COVID restrictions. It was so different. We had to wear masks all the time on campus, and then returning to campus the second time around, masks weren't required. And I just felt like, oh, I never thought about how much I planned my day around the ease of managing my pregnancy. And now just like, oh, I can go to anatomy lab without thinking twice about wearing my gas mask, taking some Zofran to manage my nausea, constantly booking like a private room in the library so I can just sit down and actually ensure I have a place to sit down on campus to study, that kind of stuff. Now it's so much easier because I don't have to think about those things. I can openly study anywhere. I don't need my own private room. I don't need to go to the library. I can just sit down anywhere and it's easy. During my LOA was actually the hard part for me because I dealt with a lot of postpartum depression. You know, I was out of school. I'm juggling life with two kids now, and it felt like I just couldn't handle everything. You know, I lost part of my identity by not being a medical student. So I felt like I was a mom and only a mom again. And there was so much to readjust because having two kids meant my first kid didn't get all my attention. That weighed a lot on me because I was used to spending so much time with him. And then now I had to split my attention. My daughter needed me more because we were breastfeeding and obviously she's smaller. So I just had to figure out like, where do I fit in everything I want to do? And as she got older, I got better managing my time. But, you know, that postpartum depression and the guilt I would have and all these thoughts I would have were really weighing down on me. And I did eventually seek therapy and I spoke to my OB about it. And I loved my OB. She was so kind to me. And she's like, don't give up on your dream. You're going to be a good doctor. This is just a phase. And I want to do what I can to help you. Again, another empathetic provider that I hope to one day be. And I hung on to what she said because every time I felt like things were dark, I would just replay what she said in my head to remind me like there's light at the end of the tunnel. And now that I'm like way past like the whole postpartum depression, I think it's a lot better now, a lot more manageable, and I'm not sad or overwhelmed or irritable all the time. It's easier. Like now I know, like I can spend time with my son by always being the one to put him down for bed versus all the other time I spend with my daughter, or like finding ways to spend one-on-one time with my kids without the other one getting jealous. And then also now balancing medical school, which is a lot easier because I ended up moving back in with my in-laws and just having their help, you know, and that's the thing. Like I was willing to sacrifice my own personal time to just make sure my kids were taken care of. Like I commute to campus whenever I need to go to campus for the most part. So Yeah, I mean, it's all about sacrifices and finding the right way to balance it all. And this is currently what works for me. And if it changes, then it needs to change. And I am now okay with making those adjustments when they need to happen. It was really hard when I had postpartum depression. Making adjustments felt like I was a failure because I couldn't do something. But now it's changing that mindset and reframing how I see things. And I get it, you know, when you're a mom, you feel so alone, especially once all those hormones are there and things just seem so overwhelming.
Yeah, oh my goodness, yes. The feeling alone with being in leave of absence. So many medical students, that is one of the most common statements that they said is just the feeling of aloneness. And something that you said, the loss of identity. I really connected with that, especially in medical. Once we achieve that status of medical students, we're so happy and brave. But then when other life challenges, we have to pause or step away from being that medical student. It is so painful and can really lead us into a negative spiral. I connected with that a lot because that's what happened when I was on my leave of absence, that just sad depression. And then now you're saying your responsibilities of having to take care of a second child and take care of your own mental wellness. Thank you so much for sharing that. Having a glimpse into postpartum depression is really helpful because a lot, again, it is stigmatized. We don't talk about it, but we're talking about it more of just that it exists and you can overcome it too, which I think is also something that you said that was very powerful. The seeking therapy, seeking support from your OB-GYN, and realizing that there is other people that care about you. And you can go forward. I'm so proud of you for doing that. And also the accommodations. I want to talk about accommodations. You mentioned them a little bit. In addition to accommodations, disabilities or testing, pregnancies, that's something I haven't talked to anyone about. You mentioned in the anatomy lab, you mentioned a private room. Is there or anything else that you asked for accommodations, or how did that go about? You were able to even start the conversation about accommodations.
So that actually started while I was still applying to medical school. I reached out to current students about what they did, what the school could provide for parents that are students. And then from there, I kind of narrowed it down. And once I got my acceptances, I really like dug in and was like asking my network of people. I was in a pre-health sorority back in undergrad. So I asked my sorority sisters to see if they knew their own like classmates that went through this. And luckily I did, like they did know someone and they were like, hey, if you decide to actually go to this school, let me know. And once I finally decided on my school to commit to, as a DO student, you kind of have to commit right away with that really expensive deposit that's non-refundable. So I made that choice fast and I was like, this is where I'm going to school. So now I need to reach out to sisters that might know someone here. And luckily enough, one of my sorority sisters had a friend in high school that actually just recently graduated from my school. And from there, I texted this person, and then she was like, I actually know two moms who had kids during our time in medical school. So let me get you connected with them. And then from there, I texted those girls, and they told me exactly what they did to get like pregnancy accommodations, postpartum accommodations, and everything else. So I kind of took their word, followed their steps, but on my timeline because I was still in the first trimester. I wasn't fully comfortable, like, you know, sharing that yet. So, you know, it's on your time when you're comfortable. But they did say, like, keep in mind, it does take some time to get through this, get this approved. You have to provide like a doctor's note, a doctor's letter, and it has to say certain things. Talk to this person from campus, like this specific faculty, about what needs to be included in that letter. So, you know, it was a lot of like back and forth with my provider, the school person, and then getting it all to come together because it was like, first, make sure my doctor's note was absolutely perfect with everything the school required. And then once that was done, it was sending it to this person. And then I had to fill out and sign up some forms, send it back to that person. And then they would have a required meeting with me to make sure they understand my necessities, like what accommodations do I specifically need that they can meet. It was a lengthy process. It took about like a month. But luckily, because I started that process, getting postpartum accommodations was a lot easier. And I took an LOA, so I didn't actually need those, but I did need to get nursing accommodations once I returned, and that was easy to start. It was just a simple letter from my OB saying, like, hey, this person needs to have a private room to pump, and she needs to have access to like X, Y, and Z, and she needs to pump every so often for this set amount of time. They even allowed me to choose my own end date, and my OB was like, hey, how long do you think you want to breastfeed? I was like, maybe a year, I don't know. And she's like, well, I'm just gonna add like a couple months extra just in case things were to happen. And I was so thankful for that. I mean, I didn't need to do it, but you know, stuff like that, you have to be so specific. And I would never have known that unless like I asked these other women about their experiences. And I wish more people would talk about it. And I did make a post on my Instagram about it, but you know, I'm only one person and I only have like so much reach in this whole giant social media bubble. So if I can at least spread the word somehow so other moms can see it, or anyone else who may consider it can see it, it's just something good to know. And I wish it was available to me without, I mean, I appreciate reaching out to all these women. I just wish this information was just out there for us. And that's kind of sad because regardless of whatever accommodations you need, it's just not out there. The process isn't there. It's just literally like, for the most part, when I looked up while in my application cycle, it was just, oh, if you need accommodations, contact this person, here's their email, here's their phone number. And that was it. Like, there was nothing more. It didn't matter what type of accommodations or disabilities, you know, that needed to be accommodated. There's not a lot going on there in this entire medical school realm, or even undergrad or whatever it is, which in my opinion needs a lot of improvement.
Yes, I'm fully with you. I'm like cheering you on. And that's exactly like my goal too, like with this podcast, with my website, like, because accommodations aren't talked about. Especially you're talking about pregnancy, postpartum, like that is such a common thing. I'm going to have to send you my blog post on accommodations and have you add that stuff on pregnancy, because that's exactly what I'm missing because I don't have that experience. Mm-hmm. But exactly what you said, the whole point is community and connection, because there's other people who've gone through it. We need to get connected to it. And that is one positive thing about social media or your sorority sisters, which is great. I love that, that connection. And that's how we can help others. Hopefully we can also encourage the educational system, not just like you said, in medicine, in residency, in work environments. This stuff needs to be said because this is not uncommon. Planning to have a child at some point, it's just not talked about. That was extremely helpful, giving ideas. Something that I'm really also glad you talked about was through the application, because that is something that I'm doing right now while applying to residency. Even though I'm not asking for accommodations for pregnancy, I'm looking for other accommodations for my own health condition. You provide me a lot of ideas, so I'm going to have to give you also that blog post so we can work on that. And a lot of people have asked about, like, how do you disclose? I think you mentioned it, but is there anything else you want to talk about regarding disclosure or including that on your application, or maybe like what you think you'll include in like future applications when you talk about your journey while being pregnant? Is there anything you want to add?
I mean, when it came down to it, I didn't include it in my application only because I didn't know I was pregnant at the time. But once I started like interviewing, getting acceptances, I kind of had a feeling, waited on the confirmation. And because of my own personal history with the ectopic pregnancy, I was really uncomfortable disclosing something that might end up, you know, not being a problem in my head. So I kind of waited it out a little bit. And I think when it comes to just regardless of whatever your concern is, your disability, pregnancy, whatever it is, it comes down to like, when are you comfortable enough to actually mention this to someone, and how safe do you feel? For me, it took me the first trimester to feel like I was comfortable enough to even share with my own peers. I mean, I told like family members, but that's like outside of my what I would call work life. So I kind of waited until I felt comfortable enough to share with my peers. And then from there, in a way, I used that as a way to like gauge like how supportive the environment was, which was silly because they were totally receptive. They were so positive. They're like, what do you need? How can I help you? What can I do postpartum for you? Like, and I was still early enough in my pregnancy. Like I just felt a lot of support. And from there, I felt comfortable enough to go and seek out accommodations from my school. Like I knew I was going to need it, but I felt comfortable enough to where, like, if something were to go wrong, I didn't know for sure how supportive the school was at the time. I could kind of complain and vent to my peers about it, but just making sure it was a way of me establishing that I did have a good support system other than just family members. And from there, you get to really hash it out with the school, like, say, like, okay, yeah, I am pregnant and I will need help. And I need you guys to provide these things for me. And the school can't tell you no because that's against the law, for one thing. Just knowing that too, I research policies in California. I go to school in California just to be on the safe side, like, hey, no, you can't do this. But I mean, that never happened. But I was making sure I was well educated on the things I knew that they were legally required to provide me and what they were legally not allowed to do. School was great about it. It wasn't too much of an issue. It may have taken a little bit longer, but at least I got what I needed. And in a way, I can't blame the process because they're trying to cover their bases and I'm trying to cover mine. And we're just trying to find a compromise and meet in the middle to the best of our abilities. If I were to, I mean, I don't even know if I'm going to have kids again, but if someone were to ask me this at like a residency interview, I probably wouldn't disclose it because I don't want them judging me. Solely on that, I would just want them to look at me as the applicant. And if it was something I really did feel like I needed accommodations or support with, I would actually engage, like, other people and how they ask the questions, like the tone, to see, like, are they actually supportive of it, or are they asking in a way to, like, look for a reason to not accept me into their program? Because I obviously don't want to go somewhere where I'm not going to be supported.
Yes, I completely agree. And that's so good that you were advocating for yourself and making sure you had all the information. Because, like you said, there are laws and protections. And thankfully, by law, they're not allowed to talk to you about pregnancy, about disabilities, about accommodations. However, like you said, things can come up. You can get a vibe. And so, it's one of those things that I'm trying to figure out how to articulate of a vibe. How do you articulate?
Yeah.
Do you get a vibe, right? It's
Yeah. I mean, I
hard.
don't have the perfect answer to that, but that's,
Don't either.
and I'm still a first year. I'm sure there's going to be ways for me to figure out some sort of method. But I mean, it's obviously, I know it's going to come up. I'm a mom. How am I going to be a good resident, a good doctor in this program while balancing motherhood? I know that's going to be a question. So I'm definitely going to gauge, like, are there other residents that are parents? Are there other staff members that are parents? Like, how do they accommodate these other faculty members of their own employees that are parents, like, stuff like that. I'm not going to go and directly ask someone unless I feel like it is really concerning. I think for now, at least, I might change my perspective, my approach later, but that's what I'm thinking currently as a first year med student.
That sounds phenomenal. And that's exactly what I think I would also recommend. And what I've heard from other individuals is definitely asking people currently, like it doesn't even have to be in their interview. You can, a lot of times they provide their emails. You have like get to meet them social. Those the time to like ask questions in regards to like who has a family? What do you all do outside of medicine? It's just part of life. It's part of being human.
Oh,
And
yeah.
it's so good to hear that you're thinking about that because, like you said, it is going to be coming. And that's okay because that's normal and that's part of your life and your journey and story. As we start to wrap up here, is there any other tips or advice you would give to other future or current health professionals that are listening to this podcast?
I mean, it really just comes down, in my perspective, to empathy. Like, I had a lot of empathy, an empathetic approach as a behavior specialist. I had a lot of empathy from my providers in the hospital when I was going through my ectopic pregnancy. I had a lot of empathy from my OB when I was dealing with postpartum depression. And I really think that approach is so crucial. And just remembering to not be so jaded, because I get it, there's so many bad in the world that you start getting jaded, and just remembering, like, why did you come into this field in the first place? And all those little moments right before leading you up to where you are now. What made you really want to do this, and why are you still doing this? And remembering all those moments and all the reasons why you remember a certain good doctor and why you want to be like them. You may be a doctor now, you just remember there was someone you looked up to, and hopefully you can still emulate why you wanted to be like them.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Kanteri. Empathy is key to life.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your journey all the way from being a translator for your family to being a behavioral health specialist, to being a pre-med, gap year, having babies. You are doing awesome. And I am so excited to see the rest of your journey and to collaborate on those, working on those accommodations, yeah. Pregnancy and postpartum. I want to thank everyone here who joined the podcast for today. If you haven't heard Kanteri, I would love to give her the opportunity to share her social media and any other way people can contact you.
Yeah, of course. So on Instagram, that's my only social media, at mommydoctor2b, and the 2 is the number 2. Feel free to message me there. Feel free to just read through all my posts, reels. I try to keep some of them informational, some of them relatable to just how life is, because I can't be the only one going through this, and I hope you don't feel alone.
Yes, thank you, Mommy Doctor 2B. I'll make sure to link down below all the amazing experiences that you've shared for other future parents or current parents that are in the medical field. That'll be very helpful. We mentioned the accommodations, so I'll make sure to link that blog post on my website, medpsychmoss.com. And I also want to encourage other individuals who are listening to this podcast. If you liked this episode, please subscribe wherever you're listening to, Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, and also to share it with someone else. Just like we talked about earlier, the collaboration and using your voice to connect with other individuals so others can hear the stories, can get the resources and the help they need and support our community of patient doctors. So thank you so much, Kanteri, for joining.
Thank you for having me.
And then you can also follow me on all social media at MedPsychMoss. And I hope to see you all on the next episode. Thank you, Kanteri.